Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on October 16, 2012. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on the property rights case argued earlier this month in the U.S. Supreme Court, Arkansas Game and Fish versus the United States. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please remember that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We welcome to our discussion today George Mason, University Law School Professor Stephen Eagle. With his work in regulatory takings and other aspects of property law, Professor Eagle is the perfect commentator on our topic of discussion today. He's the author of a leading treatise entitled Regulatory Takings, 4th Edition, and is also an author of many scholarly and popular articles. As well, he is a longtime Federalist Society leader and volunteer, so we're particularly pleased to have him as our expert on today's call. His full bio is available on our website and was sent to you in the notice of this call, so you can consult that for more information on our speaker. He's going to speak for some 10 minutes and then take questions from the audience. And with that, Professor Eagle, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thank you, Dean. Good afternoon. I appreciate the Federalist Society giving me this opportunity to speak about an important Supreme Court takings case. The court's doctrines controlling liability for government actions that adversely affect landowners have been notoriously incoherent. At various times and for various purposes, the court has drawn lines between government physical invasions and, quote, public programs adjusting the benefits and burdens of economic life to promote the public good, close quote, permanent versus temporary physical invasions, and temporary physical invasions versus government torts. As we'll see, the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission case primarily is about takings versus torts, but in fact it implicates all of those concepts I just mentioned. The case, which was argued on October 3rd, centers on whether the government's actions that resulted in millions of dollars in losses should be considered as physical takings on one hand or torts on the other. The case involves controlled flooding from a government dam that resulted in the U.S. Court of Federal Claims awarding the petitioner $5.8 million. A divided panel of the Federal Circuit reversed, and the Federal Circuit subsequently denied rehearing en banc, with four judges dissenting. The Arkansas Commission almost certainly would have no viable claim in tort, since both the Federal Flood Control Act of 1928 and the discretionary function exception to the Federal Tort Claims Act preserve the government's sovereign immunity. On the other hand, the takings clause is self-executing. During his oral argument for the government, Deputy Solicitor General Edward Needler mentioned that the Flood Control Act's disclaimer of government liability as a way of alluding to public policy concerns he wanted the court to take into account. But Justice Scalia replied tartly, "Of course, that can't overwrite the takings clause, can it?" Briefly, the facts in Arkansas Game are that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers discharged water from the government's Clearwater Dam in southeastern Missouri, submerging valuable bottomland for prolonged periods during summers, an unusual time, and resulted in millions of dollars of damages to hardwood trees on the commission's wildlife management area. The water flows continued for seven consecutive years and represented a departure from the dam's previously established water management plan. That deviation was designed to protect the crops of farmers, but at the cost of severely damaging the commission's property. The Court of Federal Claims, which Chief Justice Roberts praised for its very exhaustive findings, used the amount of loss to the commission's timber as a measure of takings damages. The Federal Circuit reversed the award of damages, stating that a taking involving a permanent condition of continual overflow or permanent liability to intermittent but inevitably recurring overflows would constitute a taking. But it said this was distinct from a tort an injury that was by its nature indirect and consequential. Here, the Federal Circuit said it was anything but inevitable that the government would continue the temporary policies that caused the flooding. Turning to the Supreme Court oral argument, the justices seemed concerned both with technical issues of what permanent and recurring and inevitable flooding might mean, and whether water discharges from federal dams inherently adjust the burdens and benefits on downstream owners in complex ways. James Goodhart, arguing for the Arkansas Commission, began by declaring, "The issue is whether temporary flooding can ever constitute a taking under the Fifth Amendment. The Federal Circuit said no, never." Deputy Solicitor General Edwin Kneedler, asked by Chief Justice Roberts whether he agreed with that characterization, responded that the court's leading physical takings precedent, Loretto versus Teleprompter, required that there has to be a permanent, not a temporary invasion, and also distinguishes the category of cases in which there is conduct outside the landowner's property that has consequential damages within the property. Both advocates proposed bright-line tests. The commission's argument was that a permanent effect of flooding, that is, permanent damage, was enough to satisfy the act as being a taking, but that seemed to get no traction with the court. Mr. Kneedler, for the government, suggested that a flooded landowner above the dam might have a takings claim, but that one below the dam simply would not have a takings claim. He added, "I think the necessary consequence of this court's holding, and it may have harshness under some circumstances, but again, when you live on a river and you know the consequences." None of the justices seemed to buy that position either. More in the mainstream of the argument, Mr. Kneedler argued that the Corps of Engineers did not make a decision to flood the commission's land, but rather made seven separate decisions each based on that year's facts. In answer to several questions about long-term flooding, he stressed that decisions to deviate from the water management plan were in fact made anew each year. He also said that damage to a given downstream owner was only, quote, incidental, close quote, a tort at most. However, in response to a question by the Chief Justice, he conceded that flooding caused by government tanker trucks dumping their contents directly on private land would constitute a taking. Several of the justices pressed both lawyers for guidance. As Justice Breyer, who seemed sympathetic to the possibility that the government's flooding was, quote, permanently intermittent, put it to Mr. Goodhart, "So what do you suggest would be a better, clearer rule for compensating for flooding when our problem is what's a trespass and what's a taking?" Likewise, Justice Kennedy asked Goodhart, "How do you define the baseline of protected expectations for the property?" Goodhart conceded, "I guess I must say it may not be a bright line." Perhaps leery of Justice Kennedy's baseline of protected expectations test, which might be akin to the fuzzy Penn Central investment back test for regulatory takings, Goodhart told Justice Breyer that a rule adopted by the court would have to remain consistent with how this court analyzes the physical takings, not use anything from regulatory analysis here. All of that said, it seems to me that Justice Kennedy's point relates to the notion that somewhere down the line, at some point after continual flooding, a landowner might conclude that the flooding is simply going to continue and use that land in the future accordingly. Chief Justice Roberts posed to Mr. Kneedler a hypothetical that government says you may not be able to use your land because of what we are doing for 2 months. You have been able to up to now, but from now on, for March or April, you can't. That's not a taking? Here, Kneedler shifted ground, stating that the Corps of Engineers has to take into account multiple considerations. In this case, there were marina operators, there were farmers along the river, there were drainage districts. This is a classic case, he continued, of government distributing burdens and benefits. Justice Scalia seemed a little dubious at this. He said, "I mean, the issue is who's going to pay for the wonderful benefit to these farmers? Should it be everybody so that the government pays, all of us pay through taxes, Or should it be this particular sorry landowner who happens to lose all his trees? While Needler said that the Corps had tried to develop a consensus of downstream water users, Chief Justice Roberts observed that this might result in one of 10 landowners being flooded and the others being very pleased with the consensus. Justice Sotomayor also seemed displeased with the answer, saying, "Permanency, permity, repetition, nothing counts, he just loses," referring to the one owner who suffers the burden. In his rebuttal, James Goodhart for the commission stressed the possibility of flooding that riparian owners faced was not an issue in this case. If it's not superinduced invasions directly from the United States, the landowner is going to have that as a natural condition. Here, it was certainly not the case. Summertime flooding of this type never happened in recorded history. So, both the government and the landowner proposed a bright-line test. The Supreme Court seemed, at oral argument anyway, unhappy with both. It pressed both litigants to come up with a more concrete test the court would use. It appears from my view in the court and reading the transcript that neither was up to the challenge. Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much, Professor. Let's go to the audience and see if they have some questions for you today. Let's go to our first question.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. It would seem that you are reprising Barron v. Baltimore, thus illustrating the old saw that in law and politics, nothing is ever settled, finally. But I think the question needs to be asked, if it is a taking, is it not perhaps a grounds for relief of the government simply purchasing the land outright and paying the owner for all of it? Perhaps giving him first right of first refusal on a lease to use the land when and where possible. This is an ongoing situation. It would seem a cleaner solution is just for the government to buy all the land.
Well, Barron versus Baltimore referred to the fact that originally the states were not liable under the Fifth Amendment for takings damages, although in fact they were liable under their own constitutions. Here, of course, it was the federal government through its federal dam which performed the acts which might constitute a taking. And for that purpose, states which are aggrieved by this are treated as if they were private landowners. Yes, I agree that one possible solution would be for the U.S. government to purchase the game reserve. And actually, what it really would have to purchase is not even that, but rather simply a flowage easement, which is to say an easement to be allowed to use the land for recurrent flooding from time to time. And the measure of how much that should cost probably would be the value of the land in fee simple minus the value of the land subject to the easement. But even there, it gets a little tricky because this is not private land that's readily bought and sold. There's not a real market for nature preserves. And so it would be difficult to, in fact, figure out what the government's damages would be, even though, even if the government were inclined to buy the land. Actually, of course, the government simply could have paid. The government could have done that, but it simply wanted to establish a precedent or continue an existing precedent from its view that even under these circumstances, the government is not liable for downstream flooding from government dams.
Let's go to the next caller.
Hi, Professor. Don Padu in Washington, D.C. During oral argument, Justice Breyer pointed out to the lawyer arguing for Arkansas that there were 11 cases by Justice Breyer's count that supported the government, and maybe one case, Dickerson, that supported Arkansas. I've read the briefs, including the Amici briefs. Do you know what 11 cases Justice Breyer is referring to?
Yeah, I don't have a list of them in front of me, but it did refer to basically all of the cases like Segui and Kress and the other cases referred to in the argument itself. If you have a chance to, you certainly might want to read the decision in the U.S. Court of federal claims, which, and this is at 87 Fed Claims 594 by Judge Charles Leto. And his opinion actually goes through all these cases and points out the ways in which none of those cases was exactly on point. In some of them, for instance, the government, the private landowner was simply talking about damages to the particular items and not takings as such, which the Supreme Court picked up on in its review of those cases, which may have led the court to some kind of path dependence in the 11 cases Justice Breyer mentioned. But none of those cases was exactly on point. So this is really a new issue for the court.
If I can ask a follow-up, that kind of leads to the other thought that I had is when you read the filings and a little bit during oral argument, there was some discussion about, you know, particularly the Sanguinetti case, how much of that holding was really a holding and how much of it was a dicta that, in your phrase, led the court into path dependency in deciding other cases. None of the justices really seemed to pick up on this idea of looking at past precedent and deciding how much of this was a holding and how much was dicta. Is that something you think, looking into your crystal ball, that they're going to worry about, or are they just going to move on?
It might be something they worry about, but I think they're genuinely concerned that this is a very big issue that the parties simply haven't provided a good solution to. Certainly, from my perspective, Mr. Goodhart's argument for the commission that if it's a permanent injury, it's a taking, is problematic simply because a tort that's just a momentary accident can result in permanent injuries too. So the nature of the injury doesn't exactly tell us whether the injury was deliberate or by accident or repeated or not, or whether the government would have reason to know that this was a direct and natural consequence of what happened. Deputy Solicitor General Needler's argument for the government that if it's downstream, therefore it's not a taking, he's literally drawing a bright line at the dam, doesn't really make sense either, because in fact, if government announces a permanent water management plan that always would put the flooding on certain lands, that would seem to me to be indicative of the cases which the Supreme Court had mentioned in the past might give rise to takings liability.
Thank you.
Professor, while we wait to see if there are additional questions from the audience, let me make an announcement about our upcoming schedule. Tomorrow we're going to host a teleforum conference call on patent rights with Professor Richard Epstein. Among other things, he's going to be discussing recent statements by Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals Judge Richard Posner on patent rights. And then next week, we'll be hosting teleforum calls on Hosanna Tabor. That's the unanimous U.S. Supreme Court decision on the ministerial exception, and also an update on the crisis pregnancy center litigation. The Hosanna Tabor call will be Monday at 3, and the crisis pregnancy center litigation update will be Wednesday at 1. While we're waiting to see if we get another question, Professor, let me ask you, is the court, in your opinion, trending in a pro-property rights direction or not? And I'm thinking, you know, think back to Kelo or Stop the Beach Renourishment, the Sackett case. What is your sense of the trend of the court?
Well, Dean, certainly the court seems rhetorically to be somewhat sympathetic with property rights, or putting it another way, some of the justices, especially Justice Alito, in the Sackett case, for instance, seemed very concerned about these rights. I see Sackett more as an administrative law kind of issue, whether the government has to, whether the landowner has a right to bring an action by the EPA or by the Army Corps of Engineers into court before enforcement is undertaken, which will result in draconian penalties. Kelo, of course, was perhaps a low point from the point of view of property rights advocates in terms of the government taking a very, very broad perspective on takings. There is one other case, I should add, which is coming before the court this year, where the court has just granted cert last week, Kuntz versus St. John's River Management District, and that's the docket number is 11-1447. I think that also will be a very major case because that will give the court a chance to review its Nolan Dolan set of rulings, which talk about under what circumstances would government exactions be unconstitutional. In Nolan and Dolan, the court said there had to be a sufficient nexus between the government's action and the problem that granting a development permit would solve. In Dolan, the court referred to the fact that the government would have to do an individualized determination to ensure that there was rough proportionality between the problem created by granting the permit and the government's solution to that problem. But the court has never decided, even though lots of people have asked them to over the years since then, whether in fact the denial of a permit because someone didn't supply the exaction requested triggered Nolan Dolan, and also whether an exaction of money or an exaction of services or other goods aside from real property satisfied Nolan Dolan. So I think that Arkansas Game and Koontz together this semester, this term of the court would give us a good indication of where the Supreme Court's property rights jurisprudence stood. And unless you have another question at the moment, let me make another observation about the Arkansas Game case.
We do have one more question.
Okay.
And I wanted to ask a follow-up question. Does it matter here in the present case that we're not dealing with an individual private property owner, that we're dealing with a state entity, essentially?
I don't think so. The normal rule is that if one government entity has the power to take property belonging to another government entity, that the government entity from which the property was taken is treated as a private landowner. That typically comes up where a state, for one reason or another, owns land in another state, and that state is simply treated as any other private landowner for that purpose.
Okay, very good. I think you were going to mention another aspect of the
yes.
Arkansas case. Why don't you go ahead and do that, and then we'll get to the next audience member
question.
Okay,
one thing about this oral argument that surprised me is that the justices and the litigants were talking back and forth about burdens and benefits being put either on one particular landowner or on the public as a whole. There is a classic Supreme Court case dating back to 1928, Miller versus Schoen. Actually, the family pronounces the name Shaney. Miller versus Schoen, which involved a Virginia case where the state cut down cedar trees because the cedar trees harbored a cedar blight, which was harmless to the trees, but great damage resulted to the apple crops in nearby orchards, and the state simply decided that the apple crops were more valuable than the cedar trees, and therefore they would sacrifice them. I could understand that certainly from a perspective of the public good, but the problem is that government can act under the police power to protect the public good, and it also can act under the takings power. So, for instance, if government were to take my car and put it across the road to slow or stop a careening truck and my car were destroyed as a result of that, that would certainly be for a valid police function, but yet my car was taken to do this, and it certainly would be a taking. And so the question comes up in the Arkansas Game case. It's true the government may have decided in perfectly good faith to spare the farmers' crops and let the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission bear the brunt of the damage, but that's what takings are for, to do the public good. So it's hard to see why the same act committed year after year with knowledge of what the consequences would be couldn't be looked at as a taking as well as a tort.
All right. We have at this point one more question. Let's go to the next audience question.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. It might be worthwhile to examine the property rights history of the litigants here. How did the federal government acquire the land on which the dam is built?
The dam was quite a distance upstream. I assume that eminent domain may have been involved in that, but I'm not clear why that's germane to this case.
Okay, well, let me explain here. It makes a difference how they acquire title, because the original concept when this country was set up is that states and states alone had power of eminent domain over their own territories. If the federal government wanted to take land through eminent domain, they had to get consent of the state legislature. Now, they had power of eminent domain over non-state territories, and of course, through admission, there could be a grandfathered retention of property rights to property that was included in the territory of the new state. But it does raise a question, because we have two essentially conflicting sovereigns contending for the same land, and it would seem that the principle of eminent domain, if it was applied in the original taking acquisition without the state's consent, would call into question whether or not the federal government even owned the dam.
Well, it is true that I think until around the 1850s, when the federal government did want to condemn land, it went through state courts. But that was not regarded, well, the first case to really focus on the federal government's taking land in federal court, and I don't have the name of that at my fingertips, said that the federal government had, as an attribute of sovereignty, the right to condemn land. So, in fact, I don't believe that the federal government's right to condemn land, even owned by a state, has ever seriously been contested. And I don't know whether the land was owned by the state here. That certainly was not an issue in the Arkansas Game and Fish case.
And are there any amicus briefs that might provide more clarity of the issues than the litigants themselves are providing?
I don't recall any the amicus briefs discussing that particular issue. There are quite a few of them, and it could be that one of them does. But the Supreme Court in these cases has treated the states as, in effect, being simply landowners and subject to the federal government's power of condemnation.
Okay. Well, Professor Eagle, it looks like we've exhausted the questions from the audience. I want to give you a chance to express any final thoughts you might have and wrap up.
Well, simply that you mentioned before, Dean, you asked about the Supreme Court's approach to property rights, and it seems to me that there was certainly a period of time, and the Lucas case back in 1992 was emblematic of that, where the court was really looking for bright line rules that would help it deal with the takings cases. Certainly the court in recent years has apparently abandoned that attempt with respect to regulatory takings, now clutching more tightly than ever to its very fuzzy set of Penn Central rules. And in the area of physical takings, that seems to be more open and shut, although in fact the court never has decided exactly how long a governmental entity has to physically intrude on certain property before it's regarded as a taking. Maybe this case will help give us some clarity on that, but my own suspicion is the court is not going to develop any kind of absolute rule. It may lean on the findings of the trial court, which were very detailed, but this turns out to be not as open and shut as physical possession versus non-possession would have it at first glance.
Well, Professor Eagle, that brings me to one more question. I wonder if you want to take this or not, but I wonder if you want to get a little finer on the role of the court. Are there any particular justices that you think of as particularly strong on property rights or particularly weak on property rights?
Well, interestingly, in this case, it seems like Justice Breyer, for instance, as I mentioned, seemed to think that if government engages in a certain kind of conduct for a substantial period of time, it wouldn't be amiss to talk about that as being permanent. So I sense that possibly he might be a vote for the commission. Even as I said, Justice Sotomayor seemed very concerned that suddenly there's a consensus reached by a whole bunch of folks downstream to put the burden on one particular party. So it's that kind of, if you will, analogous to equal protection kind of argument that might have troubled her. Justice Kennedy, I think, continues his pursuit of all-encompassing kind of contextual-based solutions involving concepts of substantive due process in some kind of vague way. As you know, Justice Kennedy is a fan of substantive due process and of due process in the abstract, but has had trouble applying it in specific property cases where it might indeed support the landowner. So it'll be interesting to see what he does.
Terrific. Well, Professor Eagle, I'm going to thank you on behalf of the Federalist Society for joining us today and for having attended the oral argument to begin with. We certainly appreciate that. To our audience, I hope you'll join us for our next Teleforum conference call tomorrow on patent rights with Professor Richard Epstein. And again, I invite you to visit the Federalist Society's website for a complete schedule of upcoming calls and for a catalog of previous calls that were recorded and are now available at our website as podcasts. So we hope you join us tomorrow, but until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.